It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, we talk about nurse numbers in Wisconsin. Who's leaving the profession and who's having trouble joining it and why? First, do you love a good guilty pleasure when it comes to movies? That film that you enjoy even though you know it's so bad, so low budget, so poorly acted? Many people found a new favorite this February when the movie Cocaine Bear debuted to moderate box office success.
There's something wrong with it.
Yeah, I told you there was.
Why is it acting like this? Did you feed it cocaine?
No, but you're safe. Bears can't climb trees.
Of course they can.
Then why are you up here?
As the title suggests, the movie's about a bear that ingests cocaine and goes on a rampage. It's actually a dramatization of a real news story about a bear that died after eating a duffel bag of cocaine in the 1980s. It might not have been a very complex plot or even a good one, but the $35 million project brought in over $23 million on its opening weekend alone. And that's not too far behind Marvel's Ant-Man sequel from the billion-dollar Marvel Universe. It's just the latest example of an absurd low-budget movie seeing mainstream success, something that's been an important part of the Hollywood ecosystem for going on decades now. So it's your turn to add to our list of the best trashy movies. Did you see Cocaine Bear? What did you think of it? Good? Bad? So bad it was good? And do you have others for us this afternoon that would be so bad they're good and we should put them on our list? Tell us your favorite trashy movie. Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post it up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, where she actually teaches a class called Trash Cinema. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Lee. Thanks so much for having me on. I love talking about trash.
Good, because we've got a list here, but it starts with the latest, and that would be the popularity of Cocaine Bear. What do you think about it? How does it compare to the rest of the trash cinema genre?
Well, you know, clearly audiences are really looking for something escapist, right? When we want to go see a movie called Cocaine Bear, it's kind of funny because although Cocaine Bear has this image as a trashy movie, it actually kind of had a big budget. Not a big budget for a movie produced terribly recently, but $35 million, that's pretty significant. So it's kind of funny to look at that film in particular as a trash movie, because a lot of trash movies, they're really on the fringes.
Yeah, so what makes a movie, in your opinion, Jocelyn, so bad that it becomes good, or so trashy that it needs to be watched?
Well, I often tell my students there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. There's just pleasure. I don't think we really need to feel bad about most of the things that we enjoy or most of the things that we're interested in. And as a matter of fact, this kind of trashy, low-budget cinema, it is completely entwined with the entire history of cinema. If we look all the way back into the 1920s, 1930s, very, very early 1930s, there's a practice called exploitation cinema. We hear that term and we think, oh, that must mean people being exploited, which is actually not what it means at all. It means the kind of, well, there's a few different opinions as to where the term comes from, but it comes from the idea of using advertising, which was called exploitation at that time. So really doing a lot of gimmicky advertising, kind of similar to actually what we would see with Cocaine Bear, right? Like lots of sort of gimmicks and like high profile advertising around it that's designed to get people into the theater.
Yeah, and Cocaine Bear seems to be part of a modern trend opting for some ridiculous plots involving fantastical creatures. The one that comes to mind here is the Sharknado. It's not even one. It's an entire series. It's a genre unto itself of sharks falling from the sky. It goes back to, I think, 2013. Here's a clip from the original Sharknado.
Every time it rains in L.A., everyone swears it's the storm of the century. And even if it is, Beverly Hills emergency services are second to none. We're safe here.
There are sharks flooding the streets. And now there's one swimming in your pool.
Are you kidding? Sharks in the swimming pool is impossible.
Well, I think you can guess how that ends. Now, Sharknado, never on the big, big screen, made for TV, but how much does the medium play a role in how these movies are received, Jocelyn?
The medium plays an enormous role. So to go back to, of course, I'm a historian, so I'm going to talk about the history of foul movies and trashy movies. Going back to the moment of exploitation cinema, which I mean, it's just wonderful. If you want to see wild movies, Sharknado is one thing, but try watching Duane Esper's Maniac from 1934 if you want to see something truly outrageous. I mean, that movie has actual cats fighting next to women fighting, right? So it's like an actual, you know, doubled cat fight that happens on screen. It's just remarkable. But that moment in time, you know, exploitation films, they wouldn't be shown in your traditional fancy, nice downtown theaters. They'd be shown with a practice called four-walling, where the directors and producers would rent out a theater for the night or for a couple nights. They might show even in like carnival tents at the edges of town. And this kind of points to then a long history of bad or trashy or outlandish or just plain tasteless movies being shown in theaters that are like on the wrong side of the tracks, right? They're a little bit vice-ridden, a little bit outré, and that actually just adds to the mystique of seeing something that's a little bit verboten, right? And then we just like want to see it because it's in this kind of like, ooh, this slightly dirty place. Now I really want to see this trashy movie.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Lease, associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, who actually teaches a class in trashy movies. So you're talking to the expert here. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, good afternoon. You got a trashy movie for us?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So I was calling for a couple of things. I wanted to give a mention to some of the schlockiest cinema of the 60s and 70s with some of the black exploitation movies, as well as the, I can't remember the name now, but like the Toxic Avenger, some of those films.
Sure.
And then you already mentioned Sharknado. Some of the sequels to that are even more absurd. And then in my experience, I found that if a movie is a little more self-aware of the fact that it's very bad, it's more enjoyable often.
Oh, I appreciate that, Michael. Thank you for the call. Sharknado, not just the original, but the sequels. And there were some spin-offs, too, as I understand it. But let's talk first about the blaxploitation films. Where does that fit in the trashy film discussion, Jocelyn?
Oh, I'm so glad that Michael brought those up because they're such fascinating documents. First of all, they're like every movie, right? But especially like trashy movies or lower budget movies, blaxploitation movies are really a time capsule. Right. So if you're seeing these lower budget movies, especially from the 50s, 60s or the high point of blaxploitation, which is in the 70s, the people making them didn't have a ton of money for set dressing necessarily. Right. So you get a lot of stuff really shot on location in apartments that people actually lived in. You get like wonderful images of what New York looked at like at that time. So they function as this on one level as like a fascinating time capsule of the moment. But blaxploitation is such an excellent example of the kinds of things that trash cinema can do. And that's because trash cinema operates at the boundaries of polite society, right? Mm. It's like tasteless. It can be vulgar. It's outrageous. All of these things, blaxploitation certainly is. But at the same time, because trash cinema operates at the fringes, it can do things that mainstream cinema can't do. So with blaxploitation, even though, you know, it's not like moral cinema, right? It's not like, oh, we should follow all of these, all of the practices that everybody does in these movies. But they're movies where there's actually black representation at a time that there wasn't, right? So they're a perfect example of how trash cinema can combine this very sort of outrageous approach with a bit of a political edge. So they're just wonderful examples.
And also, Michael mentioned The Toxic Avenger. The other movie that popped into my head when he mentioned that was Evil Dead. These horror films that are on a string of a budget and yet somehow gain, through time, over time, a real cult following.
Sure. I mean, The Toxic Avenger is, of course, a Lloyd Kaufman movie. He is the kind of more like 80s, 90s king of really trashy movies, heading up Troma Pictures that just made, I mean, the Troma movies are just like, they're disgusting, right? They're like absolutely disgusting. But he was one, he was a producer in a long line of directors and producers like Herschel Gordon Lewis, like Roger Corman or Larry Cohen, who are kind of like these amazing auteurs of absolute schlock. Right, like that is where Lloyd Kaufman operates, and I love thinking about him not as a kind of standalone figure, but as somebody who took inspiration from these other folks. Again, Roger Corman, Herschel Gordon Lewis, of course, who directs Blood Feast in 1963, which is one of my favorite trashy movies. It is trashy to the extreme. So, yeah,
Blood Feast. Let's go now to Kim in Brookfield. Kim, good afternoon. I understand you've seen Cocaine Bear.
Yes, I have seen it. My husband and I went to see it last week.
And?
Or 2 weeks ago. Honestly, I was wondering where Hollywood's going with this. We were deceptive. It was very deceptive, the advertising for it. We just thought it'd be kind of like thrilling, whatever. I found it to be very, very gory, extremely gory. I was also a little taken back by the fact that there were like 12-year-old kids that were using language inappropriately, trying drugs. And even though it was kind of funny that they did it in a, not the way that, you know, whatever is supposed to be kind of funny. I don't think it was funny. I just kind of felt like, they're promoting some really bad ideas. And, we looked at each other like, when are we walking out? And we just kind of sat there thinking, oh, it's going to get better. There might be a plot. I don't know. But and I really don't know if it was really based on a true story. I mean, none of that was really too real except for the bear ate.
Yeah, it sounds like you were a little disappointed by the film, Kim. And is part of this the marketing of Cocaine Bear, that it wasn't on the fringes, that it was on the big screen, Jocelyn?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the problem is here, because when I teach trash cinema, we're not really watching movies that were extremely popular. They're really more cult movies. Yeah. It was something I found kind of mystifying in the marketing for Cocaine Bear, because it's trying to sort of walk this tightrope where it's got like a pretty good budget. It has to make back that $35 million. That's a lot of money to try to make back. So you have to bring in larger audiences, but then it's also trading on more kind of cult iconography, things like things that are shocking, right? Trash cinema deals in shock. That is its main calling card. So I was actually a little bit surprised by how this film was promoted. I think often when we come away from a movie, thinking that something was wrong with it, often it's that it didn't meet the expectations that it promised to give us. So I was a bit mystified by that myself.
We're talking about trashy movies and your favorite trashy movies with UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Kim, thank you for your call. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. She's a film professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches a class called Trash Cinema. And that's exactly where we're focusing our attention this afternoon. With us today to talk about the recent success of the movie Cocaine Bear and the long history of bad films that we can't get enough of. And we're taking your suggestions and your favorites at 1-800-642-1234, where Karen in Appleton standing by. Good afternoon, Karen.
Hi. My family's favorite is the original The Highlander.
Yeah.
Very dark as far as cinematography. You can barely see what's going on. The acting is atrocious. There's hardly any dialogue, and the premise of immortals that can only be killed if you cut off their head, and the last immortals that face off to each other get all of the power that's been accumulated. And then they did, I think, two follow-ups on that, which were really bad. And then they did a series that was, they tried to clean it up a bit. But it's a family favorite. We go to it. We bought a copy of it, and it was still very, there was no lighting or anything like that. Everything was really shot in dark, shady hues. But my husband and I were on Netflix the other day, and they had it on, and we watched it, and they have gone back in and re-edited it.
Oh.
They lightened it up, and they added some scenes that were deleted. And, of course, the soundtrack is with, I just had it on the tip of Queen. So there's some pretty good songs, but it's still a pretty bad movie.
Karen, I thank you very much. That's a Sean Connery flick, isn't it, Jocelyn?
It is, yeah. And I thought there could be only one, but that's a Highlander quote.
Nice.
I'm so glad to hear a shout out to the bad acting of trash cinema, because that really is a hallmark, right? We really notice the unprofessionalism when we see amateurish actors. And I kind of love watching bad actors in trashy films, because they speak to the way that trash cinema breaks apart the illusion of film, right? It's like we watch something that's this bad and maybe we laugh at it, but I think one of the things that we find kind of uncomfortable, and that therefore I find actually really generative and interesting, is that We no longer are completely immersed in this filmic illusion. Instead, we're starting to see real people. And that's when things start to get really weird and confusing. And I think that's one of the really wonderful things about trash cinema.
Could we add, since she mentioned the Queen soundtrack, could we add Flash Gordon to that? That's what made me think of it.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
not the best acting there either. Let's go now to Lucas in Jefferson, who joins us at 1-800-642-1234 with one of his favorite trashy movies. What do you have, Lucas?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So in college, I was introduced to the subgenre of trashy movies, trashy like horror films or slasher films. And so my favorite was actually, it's called Thanksgiving. And it reverberates around a turkey that gets brought to life and goes about exacting revenge on people who eat turkeys.
Now, why didn't I think of that? Long before it was Cocaine Bear, it was Revenge Turkey Thanksgiving. Are you familiar, Jocelyn?
Yes, but
really,
that movie, can I just talk about one of my favorites then? Because it really makes me think about one of my favorites.
Yes, please.
If we're in this theme of like eating and trashy movies, or like the revenge of the thing that you're supposed to enjoy, especially as a good American consumer.
Yeah.
From 1985, Larry Cohen's The Stuff, which is about ice cream that kills people to eat it. But it's so amazing, because in the beginning, like, I can barely talk about this without like laughing my face off. It's so funny. In the very beginning, there's a bunch of miners who just kind of come across this stuff bubbling out of the earth, and then they start eating it and realize it tastes good. And that's just the opening of the movie. It's just wonderful, but it's also a satire of American consumption habits, right? Like how what we eat actually like consumes us from the inside. But it's just wonderful. It's wonderful. It would make a great double bill with Thanksgiving.
Speaking of double bill, let's go now to Gary in Milwaukee, who joins us. Gary, do you have a trashy movie for us?
Well, I mean, I have a question. Yeah. I go back to the 1970s for this, but I'm wondering if the early 1970s, I'm wondering if some of these trashy films were reserved just for the unique environment of an outdoor theater. I'm thinking of one in particular, The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant. It was so bad, but so good. And there's also Frogs, Phantasm. I mean, these movies, when I left the theater or drove out of the movie theater, I mean, I felt like I had damaged the way I perceived the world. It was such an experience to watch these things, and they were horrible, but I never forgot them.
And now
just for the outdoor theater.
Yeah, I'll never forget The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant, Gary, so thank you. And yeah, the old drive-ins, Jocelyn, and how it really didn't matter what was showing on the screen. It was about the event, the occasion, the evening, to just go somewhere and do something. How much do the old, since we don't see them so much anymore, the old drive-in play a role in the rise of trashy movies?
Oh my gosh, so much in the 70s, especially, right? Because you can have these kind of late night showings at the drive-in. They have to sort of fill time. I love the example of Phantasm, which is such a, I mean, that's such a bonkers movie, and it's a labor of love for Don Coscarelli, right? It doesn't quite work, but it just sticks with you. And the drive-in, yeah, that's such an important aspect. The other important kind of place to think about for 1970s trashy movies is a kind of companion to the drive-in. It would be a kind of like smaller theater that participated in midnight movies. And midnight movies, they were shown since before World War II. This was an kind of off and on thing that theaters did, but it really became popular in the 1970s. And there's one theater in particular, the Elgin Theater in New York, that really popularized showing kind of outlandish, trashy movies, starting with like El Topo, John Waters movies, all these kinds of sort of shocking movies that they would show at midnight and advertise thusly. And part of the appeal was that you would go to this kind of like punk rock situation and meet all of these fellow weirdos, right, watching these movies together. And I think it just speaks to how much the experience of where you're seeing those trashy movies translates to a deeper memory and a deeper kind of interest in them.
Well, our technical director brought up Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that's exactly what I thought you were describing there, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example that really, I mean, that movie has had such a sustained audience for so long because of how it's shown and because of how people participate, right? Yeah. It's only partially the movie. It's so much about the enjoyment that people have of getting together and experiencing it together.
Well, Jocelyn, I believe we're going to have to revisit this on another occasion because there is a lot more trashy movies out there than we have time for this afternoon, and a lot more that people really love, enjoy, and go back to again. So I thank you so much for sharing them with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. Trash forever.
I'm with you. Jocelyn Sepaniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. With us today to discuss why we love bad, trashy movies like the latest hit, Cocaine Bear. Thanks to everybody who called in and joined the show, and sorry to everybody who called in and we ran out of time for. I have no doubt we'll be revisiting this on another occasion. Now, coming up after the news, Wisconsin's looking at a projected nursing shortfall of about 20,000 nurses in just over a decade from now. We talk about some of the reasons for that projection and hear from a couple of leaders on the professional and educational sides of this story. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and coming up, we weigh the claims made by the newly created Weaponization of Government subcommittee in the U.S. House against the evidence they've presented so far and get some historical perspective on their ongoing investigations. Now, a checkup on Wisconsin's nurses. Even prior to the pandemic, the Department of Workforce Development was forecasting a 2020 shortage of about 2,800 registered nurses across the state. And add the pandemic, and play that forward 15 years, and we could be looking at a nurse shortage closer to 20,000. That, according to the dean of the College of Health Education and Social Welfare at UW-Green Bay. How can we account for this growing shortage, and what can we do about it? What's being done about it? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Nurses, those in the healthcare field, we'd love to hear from you this half hour. Have you recently left the healthcare field? We'd love your perspective on the profession today. Have you considered leaving? What was it that made you leave or stay? And what do you love about nursing? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Our guest, Gina Denick-Champion, is the executive director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Welcome to Central Time, Gina.
Thank you, Lee, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Jill Guttormson is dean and professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
And Gina, I'll start with you. I mentioned 2020 and 2035 with the nurses shortage. Where are we right now in 2023 with regards to the nurse numbers in Wisconsin?
Well, you can still probably ask any nurse that's working. Will tell you that the staffing shortages are there and they're real. And that when they talk about why their colleagues have left, many talk about, you know, the reason is not only sort of the physical demands, but the other role of a nurse when we've been taught to be a nurse is that whole intention piece. And the intention piece is the ability to meet and support your patients and talk with them and their family members. And that's the piece that they're missing, that they feel is one of the most important roles that they have in healthcare.
So it's the time to care for others, and that time's being squeezed. Was this something that you could say saw pre-pandemic, Gina?
Nurses will report that, yes, they were beginning to see that and feel that. And there was just, you know, a lot of let's try and redesign, but it still left nurses feeling uncomfortable with that ability to spend time with their patients. And of course, with COVID, you know, no one got to talk to the family member unless it was through virtual. And just the demands of the care of those particular individuals were pretty traumatic to many. And is what they're even seeing now, not so much the COVID, but the people that have taken way too long to go back to see their healthcare provider are coming in, you know, with multiple chronic illnesses. And again, the nurse trying to manage all of that, both meeting the tasks of the job, the critical thinking, but also the needs to want to meet and help support that patient.
And before we get to Jill, just one more question here, Gina, from your perspective leading the Wisconsin Nurses Association, what does this mean for patients and patient care?
I think that's where the moral injury is coming in for nurses, is that they're feeling that they're not doing what they want to be able to do in their role. I think what we're hearing a lot more about patient verbal abuse towards nurses, and in some cases, even the physical abuse. And that, we think, is that they're feeling that no one is there to take care of them. They're not there when they need them. The nurses are torn because they have multiple, you know, their patient load is pretty high. And we're thinking that's why the sort of the anger and the frustration is coming out. When we think about a person in the hospital setting that, you know, they are in probably the most vulnerable state they will ever be, when you think about in a hospital, because you're there because you need healthcare services, and most of it provided, you know, 24 hours a day with the nurse at the bedside.
That's Gina Denick-Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Also joining us, Jill Katormson, is Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. And Jill, has there been a similar dip in nursing school applicants or graduates?
So actually, our applicant pool has been relatively stable. The main problem in increasing the nursing workforce is that we have a lot of qualified applicants and not enough slots. So we've just recently increased our incoming class from 150 to 200 a year, but that requires really strong faculty, really strong clinical sites, and those are all resources that can be really hard to fill. And so there's a lot of work being done to try and increase nursing faculty so that qualified applicants who apply to nursing have a slot and can be trained as nurses.
And if you were to project out our nursing faculty and the teachers that would empower the next generation of nurses, what does that population look like right now, and how does it project into the future, Jill?
So we have a really impending nursing faculty shortage as well. The nursing faculty average age is over the age of 50, so nearing some of them in their 60s, nearing retirement. And so we have been working hard to get faculty interested, engaged, current clinical nurses interested, engaged in training the next generation of nurses. We have some funding from the state right now, nursing faculty workforce, that is allowing us to help support nurses coming back to school. It covers their loans, it covers their cost of the education, so that they can come out debt-free and move into a faculty role. And this is incredibly vitally important. Every school of nursing in the state is at capacity with our current faculty, and we need to expand our faculty to expand our ability to train new high quality ready for practice nurses.
So just to recap briefly, make sure I understand things correctly. We have more nursing applicants than we can actually educate right now. We have a shortage of nursing faculty, and that shortage is only going to get greater as we go through time. And this, in turn, and in part, is producing a nurse shortage in Wisconsin, which, again, is only going to grow larger over time. Do I have that about right?
You do. And I think the other thing to add in is there is currently beginning to be nursing shortage, not adequate staffing, as Gina mentioned. We need to train new nurses, get them out into the workforce, and help alleviate that stressor on the current nursing workforce. And so it becomes a global problem. Nurses are leaving because they're burned out. They can't do the work that they know they want to do at the best, highest level of their license because of some of the stressors in the workforce. And we can't prepare nurses fast enough because of the stressors in academics. And so we really need to look at this for global solutions on the training side. And then also, how do we help nurses be resilient? How do we help them stay in practice so they can serve their communities?
That's Jill Guttormson, Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing. Also joining us, Gina Denick Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. And you can see how the problem is laid out here. You're welcome to join us. And if you are in the healthcare profession, we'd be interested in what you see through your experiences and your work every day at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're Kenneth and Beloit standing by. Kenneth, good afternoon.
Hello. You, in your introduction, said 20,000 some odd nurses would be short that many. And I wondered what that number included, CNAs, LPNs, RNs, PhDs.
Yeah, that number came from the Dean of the College of Health Education and Social Welfare at UW-Green Bay. And Jill, what do we know about those numbers and the projected shortfall of nurses in the future? And I believe that was by 2035, according to the dean.
Yes, so that is nurses among different professions and different parts of practice, but the majority of them are RNs, and the majority of RNs work in acute care. So we really see the shortage most globally in acute care.
Gina, let me ask you this question. It was a story at the end of last year from the New York Times where an investigation found that hospitals, according to the New York Times, helped lay some of the groundwork for the labor crisis long before the pandemic started, looking to bolster their bottom lines. It is a business, and hospitals sought to try to get more out of less. This, according to New York Times investigation. Is this something that we would see as part of the problem and part of the nurses' shortage, Gina?
Yes, I think it's, you know, productivity is obviously very important. You know, there's the need to right now not having the bed capacity, which as these people come from the ER into waiting for those beds. So you have the ER nursing staff that is, incredibly overwhelmed. We also have once they get into a bed, we were not seeing as much staff as, we thought was important to provide that care. And, and then with COVID, the perfect storm moved on. But the numbers, I want to say the demand was already being identified prior to COVID. And I want to say that, our nurse execs in those systems were trying, to figure out how else can we redesign this? What else does that registered nurse need to be able to take care of their patients in, the best way that they can? And I think, again, that's where we kind of saw with COVID the stress of, the age of the nurse leaving because they didn't have the physical abilities anymore. The new grads not being able to be onboarded as well as they could begin because of the demand. And just a lot of things. Registered nurses are just in a lot of different places. So the demand certainly is there because they're finding places that are maybe they perceive as less stressful.
Gina Denick, Champions Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, also joining us for the discussion. Jill Guttormson, Dean of the Marquette University College of Nursing, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about Wisconsin's growing shortage of nurses, nurse faculty, and what that means for healthcare in our state. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk about Wisconsin's growing nursing shortage with Gina Denick, Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, and Jill Guttormson, Dean of the Marquette University College of Nursing. And we want to hear from you as well at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike's driving through Wisconsin. Mike, good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for having this important issue on your program. The reason they don't have enough faculty is because an RN needs to get her master's to teach, and they don't want to pay as much as they could make out in the field. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that the medical profession is all about profits, and these hospitals are making enormous profits, but the part of it is they are intentionally understaffing. As a travel nurse in Chico, California, at a small hospital in PCU, you never had more than three patients on the day shift. Your charge nurse did not take patients. They were there to back you up. They had another nurse they called a ninja nurse who would just go anywhere where there was a need. And the most amazing thing is they had a break nurse that would come to you and say, time for your lunch or time for your break. I'm taking over your patients, which never happens. Everywhere else, you go to your friend and you say, can you please watch my five patients in PCU along with your five patients? So not only are they more stressed out, your patients get worse care.
Mike, I very much appreciate that perspective from a traveling nurse. And let's take it a little bit backwards there with the profit and understaffing. When you hear about that small hospital in Chico, California, Gina Denick, Champion, what are your thoughts?
So California was one of those states where they had mandatory ratios of RNs to patients.
Oh.
And you heard that the 3-to-1, that's not what is taking place in Wisconsin. We do have had conversations about being able to demonstrate that the patient assignments that the nurse has, you know, does reflect the acuity of the patient. Oftentimes the patient that's in that bed when you start may not be the same patients that in that bed when you leave, because patients come and go all hours of the day. So it's some of this discharge planning, and then it's this big admission assessment. There's also, the need for, and what we're seeing is a little more of the increase in the support staff for the registered nurse. But the problem is we don't have enough of the support staff either. I know that California was no different than any other state during the COVID pandemic, because even though you had those mandatory ratios, you could not find enough travel nurses. You could not find, so, you know, it's not that the beds closed, it's, you know, care went on. But, and I appreciate those nurses in California that rose to the occasion to take care of those individuals.
And Jill, let me ask you about the needing a master's to be in nursing faculty, and you can make more money as a nurse, so it's financially a disincentive. How do we make, how do we compel people to get into the nursing faculty field?
So I think there's a multi-pronged approach. One, it is true, you do need a master's to teach at a BSN or above level. Teaching in ADN programs requires only a bachelor's degree. So it depends on what program you're teaching in. I think it is really helping people see the value they bring and the immense joy that actually is present in helping prepare the next generation of nurses. Your influence is multiplied by so many when you can really impact the care that patients will receive through the nurses that you're training. I think it's important we look at joint practice models so that faculty can continue to practice and teach, which then can help increase their salary. And as I mentioned before, I think it's important that we look at ways that we offset the cost of the master's, of the DNP, of the PhD, so that nurses who want to come back to be educators aren't also bearing the cost of high loans for that education.
Lee, this is Gina, and if I could just share that we had we were very successful in the last legislative session where we had $5 million was allocated to help support those nurses that wanted to become nurse educators. So it was a loan amount of either $30,000 to up to $50,000. It depended on the degree. And that rolled out in August of this summer, this past summer in 2022. And it feels as though we've had more than half of that $5 million has already been committed, if not more, to admitting those nurses. And that was despite there wasn't the ability to kind of market and really get it out there. But I think we've been very successful, or the schools have been very successful in recruiting those nurses.
I want to thank you both for joining us today. Gina Denick Champion, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Nurses Association, and Jill Guttormson, Dean and Professor at the Marquette University College of Nursing, talking about the Wisconsin's growing shortage of nurses. Now, this semester's classes will be the last at the two-year University of Wisconsin campus known by locals as UW-Richland. In the 3 months since the UW system announced the news, a group of supporters have rallied to save the campus, and local officials in other parts of the state are asking whether their two-year campus might be next. Rich Kramer reports.
It was standing room only in late January in a classroom at the UW-Platteville-Richland campus. The community was there to pitch ideas on how to save the school that has seen enrollment fall to just 60 students. University officials and state lawmakers were there to listen. Like most who spoke, Alicia Woodhouse had family members attend UW-Richland. She said the thought of losing the opportunity for local kids to get a college education without spending thousands of dollars on a dorm room makes her feel sick.
First of all, I want to say how hurt I felt when I heard that this campus was closing, because it really felt like we were not worth it, like we had been discounted as a community.
Some speakers asked lawmakers to divert $4 million from the state's budget surplus to the campus. State Representative Tony Kurtz, a Republican from Waniwok, told the group he'd already mentioned the idea to some skeptical GOP colleagues.
So I am being brutally honest with you that I could probably persuade a few, but I know it would be a fruitless effort, because we would lose.
It wasn't the message community members wanted to hear, and the end of classes at Richland is already making other communities nervous. There are 12 other county-owned campuses like UW-Richland around the state, and they've all seen enrollment fall by an average of 57% over the past decade. During that time, state lawmakers cut $250 million from the UW system's budget. Since Richland's fate was announced, some county boards have delayed maintenance and upgrades at their schools. They want the UW system to promise that they won't close other campuses anytime soon. Marathon County Board Chair Kurt Gibbs says UW-Stevens Point at Wausau has been a critical source of quality education for the area, but the board is waiting for assurances before approving parts of a $6 million maintenance request.
Yeah, if the roof is leaking, we're going to fix the roof. There's no question. But when it comes to upgrading things effectively still in their life cycle, the board said, no, let's hold off.
Last month, a group of trustees made up of Outagamie and Winnebago County board members delayed a $4 million engineering study of a proposed dining facility expansion at UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities. Winnebago County Supervisor Stephen Binder told his board they need to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars.
Neither Outagamie County nor Winnebago County want to invest money in a building if we're not guaranteed that we're going to be there for at least 5 years.
UW officials say the Richland decision shouldn't be viewed as a sign of what's to come for other campuses. And Andrew Leavitt, chancellor at UW-Oshkosh, told WPR he has assured county leaders the Fox City campus isn't going away. Former UW system president Ray Cross hoped to delay these types of conversations when he merged the state's two-year and four-year campuses in 2018. The move saved money by cutting administrative staff, but that may have also come with unintended consequences. In Richland, locals say it meant the loss of their college recruiter. Cross wanted to merge the schools with the state's technical colleges, but the idea was fiercely opposed by local tech college boards. Now he says the legislature should have a conversation about making it happen.
Should we
be like 95% of the rest of the states in this country and merge our technical and UW colleges. Is that the best solution? I think it is, but I doubt that they will have that conversation.
In a statement, the UW system said talks with community leaders around the state about the two-year campuses are underway. As for Richland, the statement doesn't suggest that the university will reverse its decision, but it does say a local technical college and high school could play a key role in the campus's long-term future. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is Central Time with a reminder you can respond to anything you hear on our station anytime by emailing ideas at WPR.org. What makes you laugh? And why is laughter so important to all of us? There are belly laughs, polite laughs, chuckles and chortles, guffaws and giggles. But what does it for you? What cracks you up? I'm asking because we'll be talking about laughter tomorrow on Central Time, and I'm not sure how often, if ever, we think about the power and the value of a good laugh. It knows no language and transcends all cultures. Laughter is more of a reflex than a conscientious response, and it resides inside every one of us. Depending on who you ask, laughter is cheap medicine, a really effective weapon, wine for the soul, poison to fear, the best reason for wrinkles, or just what makes life worth living. Whatever it is for you, we'll be talking about it tomorrow. So start thinking about it today. What makes you laugh? And why is that laughter so important? And you can let us know what it means to you. Join our conversation tomorrow on Central Time, and you can always email us your answer anytime. Ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.